cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the WTF Futurology Show. This is a live podcast. We're calling it a live cast, so we're very excited. This is a first for
Mike,
us.
Mike, it's a first for you, pal.
Yeah, it is a first for me. I mean, and for you too, fat boy.
Mm. So guys, for everybody who's here, it's not just the usual crew in the studio. We do have a couple of guests with us today.
We do.
So our guests, can you just give us a quick roar to let our audience know who's in the room? Ready, steady.
Roar!
Shit, they actually roared. I didn't realize they were going to roar. I thought you were going to cheer or something.
I wasn't sure what you were asking them. Let's just all call your names out. Yeah, go around the room, call your names out. It's like roll call. No, but seriously, I mean, guys, thank you very much for joining us in this live podcast. So we will have questions. Please just grab the mic as we go along and make this as interactive. Try and make the questions as intelligent as possible so that I can answer them and not Brett.
I feel that we're picking on Andrew again. He's in the audience as well.
Who's Andrew?
Mr. McHenry.
Oh, there we go.
So we've got a lot of friends in the audience. For everyone who's listening, we're going to try something different. And the best part about it is we're in Huawei's Innovation Center.
Absolutely.
Phenomenal place. You cannot take photos of really important stuff. Guys.
So that wall, seriously, just that wall you're not allowed to take a picture of.
Lots of selfies by the Huawei sign.
Yep.
It looks cool, trust me, we've done a couple. So I guess those are the house rules.
And if you tweet out with your face next to the Huawei sign, you can have a beer afterwards. That's on the house. Check, Pretty's running. Nick's going. Anyway, we're here to talk about the future of work. And Brett, this is not a new topic at all. It's an old topic because we've always had to work. But it's all changing. What the future of work is becoming is very, very different to what it was. And it's really exciting. I'm really excited. Certainly if we look at what Keynes, who was one of the top economists in the world, predicted at the turn of the century, he was looking at technological unemployment as well as a 15-hour work week, and we're kind of getting there. And I think what technology brings to the future of work redefines it as opposed to just the Industrial Revolution. What do you think?
I think a lot has happened, right? So we kind of miss Brett's philosophical kind of sayings because Mike does feel like he's making up things as usual.
I am making up things as well.
And I really want to talk about how did we get here? How did the workplace
Absolutely.
Go from a manufacturing environment where we used our hands to do everything? Next thing, we're all sitting behind desks and we're pretty static. And we've entered this world of digital where we've got to change the way that we're thinking. There's a whole lot of new things really happening in our society, whether it's artificial intelligence, whether it's the mobility rule rolling through, whether it's 5G kind of changing how we work.
What about basic income, universal basic income?
And we're not going to talk about universal basic income because for fuck's sakes, Mike, we talk about it every single time.
But
so there's
exciting.
A rule on this.
It is exciting. We've got Justin McCarthy in the audience here. He's built a blockchain on
UBI.
Yes,
I know. No, he's absolutely
so come
fabulous.
Come on, man. This is the future.
There is a podcast with him. It was amazing.
It was.
But we're not talking about it anymore.
Right. Okay.
And so talking about who we're talking with, we've got Brian Armstrong with us.
No. Is it doctor or professor?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Professor at the moment.
Right. So what happens when it's no longer at the moment?
If I leave it, I'm no longer a professor. Maybe it's a good reason to leave it. I don't know.
Okay. So talk about changing the workspace. You've gone from a corporate into the world of an academic.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your life at the moment. A lot of changes,
and
right?
And who you actually are. You always want to jump ahead here, Brett.
Always, bud.
Yeah, always.
No, so maybe a little to step back a little bit. I mean, I've been a businessman in the tech space for decades, as you know. And as a businessman in the tech space, as you tend to do, is you go and you talk to customers and you talk to the market to talk about how wonderful your tech is and all the things you can do. And I'd been doing that for a long time with Telkom and with BT before that, talking about the opportunities that tech creates. So I started talking about this whole thing we call digitalization. But I started coming to the conclusion that, well, the realization, I guess, that this thing we call digitalization is the tech's really important.
Yeah.
But it's as much about the changing nature of our society and the markets we serve. Mm. And it's as much about changing ways of doing business. as it is about the tech. So, I mean, you know, the usual poster children of digitalization, Facebook and Twitter, they're more about the society we're part of than the tech. The tech's good,
yes,
but they're more about society. And Uber and Airbnb and so on, they're more about the business model than the tech. So that got me thinking to say, yeah, the tech's really good, but I started to get particularly interested in this intersection between technology, business, you know, and the science of business and the way our society's changing. So when the opportunity came, I left Telkom and I was thinking, what should I do with my life? And Vitz approached me and said, we've got this chair in digital business. Would you like to have a go? And I thought, yeah, that sounds really cool. So because what it does now is it allows me to sort of try and sift through all the hype and the noise and this thing we call digitalization and try to get to the actual essence of it and try and establish a properly scientifically sound body of knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's how we got speaking about the future of work, because that's about the society that we live in.
Absolutely.
And the way things are changing. So that's what I'm doing, and it's really cool. I'm having fun.
So Brian, if this podcast completely fails, can I come work for you? Because it sounds like a really cool thing to be doing.
We can talk. Yes, of course. No, of course. You can't work for me. You can work with me.
Okay, cool.
And do research in this space.
Lovely.
Now, fantastic. It sounds more like you can do research on Mike, though.
Yeah.
He's quite a specimen.
Why do you think I offered?
Let's move swiftly on now. Yeah. So how has this... I mean, because there really are three critical questions, I think, when it comes to the future of work, really is how has the work itself actually evolved? And given that evolution, what skills do we actually need to develop? And what will the future of work become? And what are the implications in South Africa? So really,
that sounds like a loaded question. You just fired out 20,000 questions.
I want to set the scene here because, I mean, that really gets to the crux of it. How has work evolved? Because we've always spoken about the future.
The scope of those questions will sort of fill up my book, which I'm going to write in 10 years' time.
Okay.
I think it's a massive topic.
Is you a
topic.
Slow writer? Or?
I think we're still learning because we don't know. Yeah. The world doesn't really know the answer to those questions.
Yeah.
So let me give you just some... I don't want to throw out too many stats, but there's just what there's absolute consensus on is that the nature of work is changing.
Yeah.
The exact detail around that, there's no consensus. So most of us go back to there was an Oxford University, two Oxford University professors in 2013 wrote a paper called The Future of Work, which looked at sort of three dimensions of how work is changing, the level of creativity needed to do it, the level of social intelligence needed to do it, and the level of dexterity or manipulation. Mm. And they analyzed 702 jobs, and on the basis of that, they said 47% of U.S.
Yes.
jobs are going to vanish. And I'm sure you've all heard that study, and you've read sort of short reports on it. But then you go into different things. So Forrester have produced stuff which says... digitalization will create 9% new jobs, but it will destroy 16% old jobs, so the net effect is -9.
Yeah.
And then the OECD said they took the Oxford professors thing and said, no, they got something wrong, so we're doing it on a slightly different basis, and on that basis, 9% of jobs are going to vanish, and another 26, I think it was, would be severely impacted. And I could carry on this, you know, study after study, and the numbers are all a bit different.
Yeah.
The nature of what it will be replaced by is a little bit different. The mechanisms of replacement are different. But what everybody agrees on is that the nature of work will change absolutely fundamentally.
But it's always been changing, right?
But
for centuries, we've been changing. We went from farming, we went from doing high-scale farming, we started using tools, and we kept on evolving. It's just the speed that is changing out at the moment.
I think, I mean, that's, by the way, that's what gives me, that's what feeds the optimistic streak in me, right? So we've been through several industrial revolutions from, you know, the steam engine through electricity, through linear and batch production and normal production processes. And what's interesting is in all of that, I mean, by the way, Keane said we'd get to 15 hours a week. I think we're on 15 hours a day now, most of us, right?
Yeah.
It's gone the opposite way.
Yeah.
And actually, if you look at economies across, certainly across the OECD, but I think generally in emerging markets, certainly many of the bigger emerging markets, employment's actually increased as a share of population over the last 30 years. So notwithstanding, the last 30 years, it's not quite the revolution we're going into, but certainly from the 80s, the so-called computer revolution in the 90s, the internet revolution in the 2000s, the mobile revolution, employment has increased across the world.
But Brian, I mean, the interesting thing is if you look at the stats out of the US, most certainly over the last couple of years, the increase in jobs has come out of the gig economy, which is really small work pieces as opposed to formal employment. So the very nature of those figures has changed.
I think, well, there's, by the way, that touches on a whole lot of issues.
It does.
There's a huge effect called hollowing.
Yes.
Which is we are getting, we are seeing the so-called middle income, middle skills jobs going down dramatically, sort of in the 10, 15% level in many countries. And they are migrating into some more highly skilled jobs, which are many of which are in the gig economy.
Yeah.
But then also into lower skilled, unskilled jobs.
Yes.
Some of which are also in the gig economy.
Yes.
So it doesn't. The fact that it's going into the gig economy doesn't necessarily mean for average middle class Joe it's a better thing.
It's another misleading
stat. But there is one thing I wanted to say about this. These previous industrial revolutions, even to the internet one, and notwithstanding, the job market has been robust. I think there's one key thing that's changing, and that you mentioned it, the speed of change.
Yes.
And the ability of humans to adapt. One reason why employment has actually grown throughout is humans are incredibly adaptive things, creatures. So we are able to adapt. But all the previous revolutions, the lifetime of change of the technology and therefore the market that it creates has been significantly longer than the half-life in terms of half-life, you know, in scientific terms, of a human being to respond. The problem now is that the lifetime of change has become, and is even more so, getting far quicker than the ability of people to respond. And that's what feeds the pessimistic side.
So is it just the ability to respond, or is it the resistance to change that people have? Because like, if you look at large organizations, when you're bringing in new programs, new tools, especially new ways of working, and I think we need to talk about new ways of working as well, traditional organizations will fight the new breed or wave coming into the organization.
Yeah.
Is it not that that's slowing it down? Or will getting that right accelerate it even further?
I think so. So firstly, I mean, absolutely, the biggest handbrake on change is us.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think firstly, you know, there is this issue, does technological change have to be deterministic? In other words, it will happen and it will follow this. Or do we have the ability to influence that and shape it? And I believe in the latter. I think we can. Now, but it's not just a new phenomenon and it's not just a big organization phenomenon. I do believe that big organizations are, their DNA and indeed their structure is designed to avoid variance and deviation.
Yeah.
So if you're running a big business, it's about predictability, safety, risk management. So obviously on a production line, that's what you want. But that fundamental essence and DNA of what a big business is seeps through into the management behaviors and the culture of the organization. So big organizations are really bad at innovating. So that is an issue. But let's just take a fascinating example I was reading about recently. In 1589, the guy that invented a sewing machine or knitting machine, he wanted to patent this. So he took his idea to Queen Elizabeth I in London to get this patented because this would transform the lives of workers that they wouldn't have to do all this manual knitting. And she declined it. Because did he think about the impact this would have on the working class?
Yep.
And she was probably right, actually. And I think that is still very much the case, that we do have the ability, for better or for worse, to influence the path and the speed of technological progress. I mean, I think in some things like biological warfare, I think we'd all agree that regulatory intervention at the international level has been very, very good and necessary. There are other things where probably it's not appropriate, and I'm sure we'll get on to talking about the Mark versus Musk debate.
Right. Yeah,
but, you know, I think we can regulate around this. But at the same time, it's also about understanding the impact on work and what are the appropriate structures, social structures. And, I mean, you were joking about the universal wage.
Yes.
But at some point, that's the real issue. It's not, it for, has to it's not for the sort of the loony left anymore no. to talk about
no.
that.
No. I had my money on Mike bringing it up first. I didn't think you would be. So I feel like I'm coming away with an extra $10 here.
You mentioned it first. I was responding.
Absolutely. But we it's inevitable because really what technology is doing is it's redefining absolutely everything in terms of how we work, live, and play. And certainly when we start looking at this idea of exponential technology and how it's impacting on our lives and the move to singularity, which whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know. But can I jump to look at this a different way? You know, if we don't know what we don't know.
Sorry, can I just come back on that point about, you know, the work and so on and the universal wage? What is interesting is the absolute need for to do meaningful work at a human level.
Yes, absolutely.
So there are some sociologist who's apparently like the expert on this is this humans spend their time in three ways. They do paid work, they do unpaid work, and they consume.
Yes.
So what's actually interesting is paid work is what it says. Yeah. Unpaid work is actually not your charity in that, but it's organizing.
It's being friends with Mike.
No, it's outsourcing. Okay. It's organizing the plumber to come and pick stuff and maybe you know, getting your husband or your wife to do something that you don't want to do. That's unpaid work.
Yeah.
And the universal norm for that, just by the way, is 60 hours. That's a surprisingly robust number.
It's
got to be meaningful. So if you gave me $10 million a year to sit on my butt, I don't think it would make me happy.
No,
I'd want to do meaningful work.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I can vouch for that because every time I get home, every night I get home, my wife tells me how hard she's worked every day. I mean, it's a long conversation. Yeah. But she does. I mean, she's busy. Yeah. I don't know about your wife. She's too busy shopping, I think, Brent.
No, but she works hard.
Does she?
Yeah.
Spending
it's
your money.
It's a target, right? It's not a credit limit. It's a target. I wish all KPIs were set up that way.
They're very easy to perform. Jeez. I'm just better learn from this.
I'm just watching my SMSs coming in now.
Bing, 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 bing. Yeah, we better raise the rate. But coming back to the idea of work, Brian, we don't know what we don't know. And how do we prepare ourselves for a world that we actually don't understand that's coming? Because certainly the jobs that are available, that will be available, and I think of my children, my kids are 10 and 13. What they're going to do is not the world we live in, and how they work is not going to be the world. I mean, they're not even going to own cars. I can't see them actually owning a car.
I'm pretty convinced our parents used to have the same conversation, surely.
Yeah, look, I think they had a different conversation about you, but every other parent had the same conversation. I'm quite sure. I really am quite sure. But I mean, how do we prepare ourselves? I mean, you're now going into the world of academic. How do we prepare our children? I mean, Brett, maybe you could also jump in here because you went and spoke to your rector at school about this, because I look at my two little children and it scares me on one level and it excites me on another level.
Because we're actually pushing the academic society quite hard, both on getting the content right. And when I say content right, it takes 5 years to get the content into the academic streams. But in 5 years, guys, the world has changed. Drastically changed. I mean, I'm going to keep looking at the AI device and Huawei's device. It has artificial intelligence on a phone now. Last year, that was unheard of. I mean, how much must that impact the world of building handsets and preparing students to be able to do that?
I think you know, it's interesting. The more some things change, the more others stay the same.
Yes.
So let me. I haven't got any sort of pearls of wisdom or answers on this, but I've got thoughts in four areas. So the first area is the particular skill. So to learn a particular skill. So there's a lot of focus, for example, on we should teach coding and so on. And I think that's great for the next 5 years or so.
Yep.
But eventually coding will become automated as well.
No, exactly.
So you know, be very careful of the skills and the particular skills that we're learning, which then says we should teach people it's more about how to think and about how to learn. Because what's actually interesting, if you go back to when I was just starting in business, I was an electronic engineer and I had a few particular skills, but what has stood me in good stead of my career is those, let's call them old-fashioned virtues, like hard work, being able to communicate, work in teams.
Yeah, problem-solving.
Collaborate, complex problem-solving, determination and perseverance and resilience. So those things, I think those are absolutely things that are going to continue to be determinants of success.
See, Brett, it's called teamwork, bud. called teamwork.
You're saying it like I don't hang with you and do cool things.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Oh, I thought that was drinking.
But move on.
Yeah. Teamwork is drinking, isn't it?
What's actually interesting, and I mean, I use myself as an anecdote, which I'm always wary of doing. A sample of one is always a dangerous thing. Yeah. But there's this sort of myth, in a way, that says if we just flood all of our organizations with enough millennials and ponytails, everything will be cool. Everything will be right.
But just got to wear a T-shirt,
eh? Let's look at the top four tech companies, the three A's and an M, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, and Microsoft. At the time that they all established their dominance, they were led by 50-plus-year-old people. Yeah. If we look at the next three of the big three, Facebook, Tencent, and Alibaba, two of those three were created by old guys.
Yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg being the exception.
Yeah.
So that comes back to the fact that...
And sorry, Brian, he even had to get an old person to come and help him in Sheryl Sandberg.
Yeah.
So that says to succeed in business, you still need some of those old-fashioned skills, which is a bit uncool to say. And it is about being a hard-nosed businessman sometimes. To succeed in business is about being able to translate a vision into a strategy, into an execution plan, to put the action plans in place to measure performance and adapt accordingly. And I mean, that you can, that's probably about as simple as you can make it, and you can write many books on that. But that's essentially what it is. And it takes, some disciplined, hard work, and creative skill to do all that. Third point I'd like to make, if we go back to that Oxford University discussion, they define digital, automatable jobs in terms of the less dexterous it was, the easier it was to automate. The less social skills or social intelligence that it needed, the easier it was to automate. I've lost my thought. And creative, the less creative intelligence.
Yes.
So the converse of that, therefore, is to say, if we think about the future, those people that will be most able to resist the disruption of automation will be people who operate, either it's because of the job they do or they personally operate in a way which brings a high degree of dexterity. Doesn't apply to most jobs, but it can apply to some, but certainly creative intelligence and interpersonal intelligence to play. So for example, you can replace a contact center agent with a bot, but can you replace a PR investor relations person with a bot? I don't think so, because you need a huge amount of empathy. So I think that's a good way to think about it. The final point is, I mentioned that OECD study. Now what they do is there's this assessment of work which we've all looked at, which says there's basically three measures of ability, and that is your numeracy, literacy, and complex problem solving.
Okay.
Now, and that's what our education system has been hell-bent on delivering. We want to improve literacy, numeracy, and complex problem solving.
It's the education KPI.
Yeah. Now, the problem is numeracy and literacy certainly can be automated. And even in complex problem solving, here's the shocking stat that I read, that only 11% of the American workforce currently performs better than computers at the level of complex problem solving, today's level of automation.
You are kidding me.
Yeah. It is up to us to learn to use the tools at our disposal to make sure that we can solve problems better, that we are more literate and can communicate better than computers, because otherwise we will all be made obsolete.
Okay. I'm feeling kind of obsolete right now, to be honest. I'd love to get your view. Is salesman a risky kind of role, job to lose?
But even creativity, so here's an interesting one. Who remembers that song, I Took a Pill in Ibiza? Right?
Yeah, cool song. No, never did that.
The drop at the end of the chorus was actually taught in music schools as, this is how you do a drop.
Really?
That cool synth bit that sounds half like a voice, that was, you put it into Ableton, you turn up the creativity dial, and out it popped.
Yeah.
So even so-called creativity is increasingly becoming automated.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to stay on the education theme, because we're sitting in South Africa and we've got a massive unemployment problem. And I don't know if this is an opportunity in terms of what is possible with the future of work. Do you have any thinking around how do we solve this massive unemployment challenge, or how do we redefine this massive unemployment challenge within the context of future of work, and how do we enable South Africa to really leapfrog into where it could potentially be? And it's not an easy question. Yeah. I know that, because I don't know
and
what
the answer
is. And
I don't know that it's necessarily a technology answer, but I've got a few thoughts on that. So the first thing that gives me a bit of hope on this, sorry about going back to that Oxford University study again, but everybody thinks the logical inference is the less advanced you are as an economy, because we're seeing this hollowing out effect and migration to more complex jobs. People think the more advanced you are as an economy, the less vulnerable you are to this issue of job disruption.
Yeah.
The same methodology that was used in that Oxford University study was used by a German professor for Germany. And the answer that he came out with was 60% of the German workforce is at a high risk of disruption. I would argue that America's not necessarily, from a job, an overall national job distribution perspective, they are not less advanced than America. Mm. So if that doesn't necessarily follow that the level of disruption that we will face as a South African economy or an African economy will be dramatically higher than the US and the OECD data. So that gives me some hope. But I think the issue of addressing economic growth in Africa, and with it jobs, and with it inequality, requires a much bigger discussion. So the problem digitalization does is that the risk is, I mean, you talk about leapfrogging, it's possible, but there's an equally plausible outcome that it's what economists are increasingly talking now about as premature deindustrialization. That the proportion of, in South Africa, the proportion of the workforce employed in the manufacturing and the industrial sector has peaked at about 14.5% in the 2008-2009, and it's not growing. Whereas if you consider the German and the South Korean and the developed economies, it was 25-26%. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have peaked at a level of employment in the industrial sector, which is too low by global standards.
Yes.
And how do you get out of that? Because now manufacturing has become commoditized. We can't have a manufacturing-led growth strategy as South Korea did, for example, from 1950, very effectively.
Yes.
So what do we do? And I think the answer there has to be, it's a multi-pronged thing. I think there's big opportunities. And I was at a seminar with a global economist called Joseph Stiglitz, who won a Nobel Prize for economics in this stuff. And the view is it has to be a combination of smart agriculture, smart services, a degree, still pursue beneficiation in industrial, but it's the right mix of that and the right policies to promote it. But it does all come back to education. So if you take the South Korean example, for example, what actually led their manufacturing drive was a huge focus on education and investing the proceeds of the foreign exchange from the export-led manufacturing strategy into education, both formally and informally, and in the establishment of capacity. So we have to do that. And at the moment, I think if you ask me where our big issue in South Africa is our education is not delivering even those good old literacy, numeracy, and problem-solving skills. It's not even performing at that level.
We don't have the basics.
Let alone at the level that we have to perform.
I guess Access plays an incredibly important role in getting the education distributed out there and getting our teenagers and youth ready for a workspace. So surely if we're focusing purely on trying to get access in the right devices in the kids' hands to be able to at least benefit from MOOCs, you know, those massive,
massive online
courses. Yeah, that's it. Surely that could be maybe, I hate talking silver bullets in this case, but it would go a long way to be able to get the access of knowledge into our kids' hands. And I mean, like, I really do think that the right device really counts. With feature phones, that's not the right device.
I think access in terms of connectivity, access in terms of device, but it does come back to content as well. And so, for example, one of the big producers of textbooks and educational content, their model still is you pay the same price for an e-book as for a print textbook. And guys, that can't be right.
No, it can't
be. It absolutely can't be right.
That's right. The scale and the distribution margins.
It is. It's about getting the right content into people's hands in the right way. But what I'm learning, and I've been an academic for 4 months, so hey, like now, don't take this with a pinch of salt. But what I'm learning is that the translation of content from a contact delivery mode into an online delivery mode, I mean, it's not rocket science, but it takes work.
Mm.
So it will take work and time to convert all of the material that is taught in schools and in universities from a contact mode of instruction.
I guess also Khan Academy's taught us a lesson that it's no longer just a direct conversion from paper-based into, say, PowerPoint, not just video, but it's also the big data and the science that sits behind it to distribute the right content at the right time to the right capability and skills, maturity, and all that kind of stuff. That's probably far more important than just a direct conversion.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's also emerging thinking on, project-based learning, team-based learning, that it's not instructional, that it's self-discovery. I think there's a lot of evidence that says now in this new online world, there's other modes of learning that are equally, if not more effective than previous modes of instruction. Gamification is a huge topic about how you improve learning outcomes through gamification. I think many of you will have heard of it. In France, there's this academy called Ecole 42. I don't know how to say 42 in French. I can say Ecole. So Ecole 42, which is purely self-taught. It's gamified. So if you get something right, you get points. If you get something wrong, you have to go and wash the windows or clean the toilets and you get penalties. But the whole thing about learning through the system is gamified, and the outcomes of that are incredible.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that's context specific. Maybe it works in Paris. Maybe it won't work here. Although it is being done here. An organization called Rethink Code is doing it.
Yes.
And it's working.
They've got an amazing setup. I was there the other day. They're doing some incredibly good stuff.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I'm just thinking about the device. I'm fascinated about devices. We're at Huawei, and being able to, there was that revolution of smartphones, and it went onto tablets as a learning device, and you've never really seen tablets take off in the workspace. And I can remember about 3-4 years ago, Ubuntu made a big play on trying to turn a smart device into a PC. Because at least you've got a portable, and you just have to worry about getting the screen there. One of the interesting things that Huawei have done is they've really thought about how do you take a device and remove the peripherals of keyboards and mice and adapt it to the screen. So I'd love to kind of get an understanding of how that will be taken into the mobility space and work, right? Because now you don't need to carry a laptop around. You don't need to be in a particular office anymore. These devices are starting to scale basically the peripheral hardware that you always needed to consume content and be able to deliver things. That must have a remarkable effect on the way that we work.
I think what the likes of Huawei are doing with the devices to make that human, or they can call it analog digital interface, more frictionless, is incredible. I mean, so coming back to my music analogy, I spoke about that song, but as a wannabe musician, I've always known the most important parts of any signal chain is the conversion from analog to digital and the conversion from digital back to analog. Now, the world is becoming digital, but we're still analog creatures. So we need to interface with this digital world in a frictionless, seamless way, which is why AI in a device is so important, because it actually helps the frictionlessness in getting into the digital world. It helps speech recognition. That's why that's so important. That is why user interface design. Now, I talk about the analog to digital interface, and everybody thinks, okay, so this is just about user interface design, and it's not. It's far more than that. So let's say you've got a contact center, and somebody phones in your contact center. They're the analog thing, right? Each time they have to take information from the customer, key it into a system, and then they say, okay, I've got to take it out of this system and key it into a different system. Each one of those is a analog to digital to analog to digital to analog conversion. And that is where the friction in processes comes in. That is where the errors in processes comes in. It means, and that's why we can't scale, because there's all these people in these interfaces. So get something into the digital system as soon as possible and keep it there for as long as possible, and everything in between needs to stay digital.
And so your middle offices stop.
Absolutely. That's why the middle office is disappearing, why routine work, so-called routine knowledge work, is disappearing. But that is why the work the device guys are doing in the interface is actually so important. It's not just because it's funky to be able to talk to your personal assistant. Mm. It's because it steps along the journey towards a seamless analog-to-digital interface, which will eventually be completely intuitive and completely almost invisible. That suddenly we'll think, I don't want to get sci-fi here, but we will think, and it will be in the digital world.
Absolutely. Well, actually, Elon Musk spoke about that, right? He was saying the problem with artificial intelligence right now is that our inputs as humans, and comparing it to artificial intelligence, is all high dev. The problem is when we're outputting our engagement to these devices, it's all analog. It's all in your thumbs right now. So, you know, he's got this view of, you know, you've actually got to start plugging your brains in. And that starts getting scary. You can see why he starts jumping into this world of, we've got to regulate where we're going to go and what these algorithms are going to start doing. So that starts getting interesting.
For me, it's not so, the need to regulate is not so much because the blurring of the distinction between the physical and the digital world. You know, augmented intelligence and augmented humanity, or whatever you want to call it. That for me isn't so much the scary thing. Sure, we're seeing it changing. We're changing the nature of what it means to be human, and that will change more and more. What I see as more scary is there was the sort of the penny dropped for me. I was at a Web Summit in Lisbon last November, not the one that's just been. And there was an interview with Sophia. And the guy asked Sophia, so what would you like to do? And Sophia said, well, I'd like to do this job and that job and that job and that job. But what I'd really like to look forward to is when I can reprogram myself so that I can keep getting better at what I do.
Everyone ran.
This was a live interview, right? And of course, Sophia was the robot, Sophia. And I mean, I thought, wow. At what point do we start putting constraints on what we allow computers to do to reprogram themselves?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this idea that there'll be the big red button that you push off, I mean, that's bollocks. Because once a computer can reprogram itself, when they've got 10 times the numerical intelligence that we have, they'll figure a way around it. So that for me is where we need to think carefully about how do we regulate, what do we regulate, without wanting to get doomsday-ish and all that jazz.
So that's what I mean. So
Stephen Hawking was at Web Summit now, and he was saying, you know, AI is potentially the most positive thing for humanity ever, but potentially the most catastrophic as well.
Absolutely.
And I don't think he's an alarmist. You know, he's not a dumb guy, and he's not an alarmist.
So I think we're now going down that part of the show, right? Absolutely. We're starting to throw it forward a bit, and I want to kind of structure it a little bit more. And
Brett, before you do, are there any questions?
Yes, that's a good point.
Justin. Do you want to grab the mic? Go up to the podium there. There's a mic so we can get it recorded properly. There we go.
Fantastic.
More an observation than a question. I just want to go back to an earlier part of the show before you got into AI about job losses and so on. And I won't talk about UBI, Brett, probably. But I think a lot of the world is looking at technology and how it's changing the world. Well, a lot of people are looking at how tech is changing the world. And they're not, and they're looking at it through the same economic lens that we've been looking at it for the last 500 years. And economies are decentralizing, networks are distributing. The world is changing in many other ways, which including education, healthcare, things that governments have traditionally looked after and taken care of, so-called taken care of, some better than others, obviously. But we've got to change the lens at which we look through this future as well. Because if we continue to look forward using a lens from 200 years ago, we're really going to screw it up.
Mm. Totally.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very good point.
No, totally.
I agree. The principle I absolutely agree with. I mean, one of the specifics I'm not convinced about is economies are decentralizing. I think activities are decentralizing, but wealth is concentrating. So what you see, one of the challenges in the digital economy is you end up with this incredible concentration effect. So we first to scale wins, right? I was speaking to some guys in the e-commerce space this week, and there's a few dominant e-commerce players in South Africa and a thousand others who can't get capital, who can't get investors, and who can't get scale because the first to market, first to scale wins. When you extrapolate that to the global level, the big four I spoke about earlier, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, and Microsoft, their market cap is more than double the size of the entire JSE. Now, the JSE is not some small little stock exchange on the southern tip of Africa. It's one of the emerging market powerhouse stock exchanges. So everybody talks about, the internet's this amazing democratizing thing, and information equals knowledge, and knowledge equals power, and power equals wealth, and this is democratized, right? Well, no, wrong. Mm. We're seeing this incredible concentration of wealth. Now, that, I mean, depending on your view, this can be a good thing or a bad thing. Some people say, cool, give me a piece of the action. And other people will say, this can't be right. We need to do something about it. But the fact is, it's real. And if you want to talk about distribution, what really concerns me is this debate about redistribution is a national debate. It's about how we're going to redistribute from Sandton to Soweto, when the real issue is how do you redistribute from San Francisco to Soweto, which is a far bigger challenge. Yeah,
absolutely. And I know what you're going to answer, because, I mean, our current frameworks are structurally designed for those that have and those that don't have, and it's the mass is at the top or the mass is at the bottom. Yet the technology is shifting that structural framework.
Brian, I 100% agree with you with regard to concentration. I mean, that's a fact. Mm. It's indefensible, or undefendable, if you like. But the point that I'm making is that the parts of the technology, blockchain being one of them, and I'm just using that as an instance, which are beginning to decentralize those. Yeah. So, they're threatening to, or they have the opportunity to. So, while San Francisco does control the tech world and controls a great deal of the financial world as well, and the old money follows that. China, Japan, South Korea, Brazil, even in South Africa, there are tech companies emerging, or technology-based companies emerging, that will bring down some of those monsters and giants. Mm. You know, if you think about Airbnb and the beauty of the Airbnb model is based on unlocking underutilized or more moribund assets. And you think, fantastic, I can get a couple of thousand rand a month or dollars a year from space that is a sunken cost, and that's growing the economy and it's helping me, etc. But there's a giant in the middle, which is earning whatever they make out of it, 10 or 15% out of each transaction. So that democratizing or so-called democratizing business of Airbnb and Uber is a slightly different example, but a similar one, is having a very fundamental impact on having a reconcentration and creating new pockets of concentrated wealth. Mm. But that model in itself is being, well, I'm talking 20 years hence maybe, or 30 years hence maybe, but I see lots and lots and lots of opportunities for those models to be fundamentally disrupted. And a company like Facebook, I predicted it 10 years ago that Facebook won't be around by the time I die, if I live to a natural age, that is, without AI.
I mean, I agree. I think things like blockchain has potential to absolutely change the structure of economies, and certainly change the structure of the financial system. And I think, I mean, technology itself is agnostic to social outcomes. It's what we do with that technology that matters.
Yeah.
On the issue of cryptocurrencies and that, sorry, this is a bit of a digression, but we're allowed to do this, right? We're allowed to roll with it. I was at a talk recently by a well-known economist, and he's a big fan of cryptocurrencies. And the issue is we can regulate how funds get into and out of the crypto economy. But once they're in there, they're behind the veil.
Yeah.
And you just don't know what's happening there unless it's voluntarily disclosed. Mm-hmm. And once a critical mass of the world's economy goes behind this veil, the crypto veil, central banks lose their ability to control monetary policy and to control the economies of the world. And when central banks lose that ability, politicians lose the ability to control them. Mm-hmm. And therefore politics changes. So, good, bad, I don't want to make that value judgment. But certainly, potentially very disruptive.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder what the impact on the way of working would be.
There we go.
Am I trying to bring this back around?
Well, let's throw this forward a bit, yeah, Brett. I think it's time to throw this forward because, I mean, where do we see this going?
So, I mean, there's a lot of things on the plate, right, that going to change this world. And we've actually got someone who's right at the cutting edge, and I'm going to ask him to come and join us. Akram Mohammed, he's with the Huawei, and he's the product director. I saw him at the launch of the Huawei Pro, and he blew my mind away with some of the incredible technologies that are out there and the impact it's having on our society. So, Akram, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
How's it, Brett? With that introduction, I feel like I'm forced to be nice to you, but I'm not.
You don't have to be. I promise you. You don't have to be.
So, your back's giving you a bit of trouble there, right?
Yeah.
You mean worked hard?
It's Huawei.
So, guys, I want us to kind of start changing the direction. So we are talking about the way of work and the workplace and what it's going to look like. And I guess, you know, it's easy if we start picking on what the work environment's going to look like. You know, how we work is changing from an open, from a cubicle-based environment to open desktops, which is changing the way teams communicate with each other. People are on the go. That's all changing. Great. But when we start seeing things like hardware starting to eat software, and it sounds strange, right? We've been thinking of the world the whole time as software eating the world because you can scale so well with software. But when you start seeing things like artificial intelligence chips on actual devices, it starts making me think about hardware taking a dominant role on scaling what we can do with software. I'd love you to give me kind of a view on what you think this change of putting a GPU on a smartphone and kind of how that unlocks this online and offline world together, because it's going to change the way we work. Dramatically. I mean, we just saw what a smartphone did to our way of working. Email on the go. Yay! That sucked. That really sucked.
That did.
But, you know, it still sucks, right? But, you know, when I start thinking about using vision recognition APIs in the retail space.
Offline.
In the offline world. I mean, so I'd love to get a bit of your view on that, and then let's see where it goes.
So, firstly, I'm no professor, but I agree with a lot of points the professor has made. Just standing there and listening to you guys, I was thinking WTF, but in the other context.
we didn't pick that name by accident. So.
You know, just looking into what does it mean in terms of, like you said, hardware eating software. Before we go into the details of that, I want to touch on a few points that you guys have discussed about the future of work. Just today, I was reading an article on Tech Central on a McKinsey report that by 2030, 800 million or so jobs will be killed by AI. And
800 million?
800 million. That's what this report says.
And that's the whole of Africa.
Maybe more.
No, it's more.
It's more.
It's more. I mean, we've got a population in Africa of probably 1.3 billion, but how much employed?
Yeah, employed.
I think to make it worse, a billion in Africa, a billion new jobs need to be created.
Correct.
In
yes.
The next 15 years.
Not removed.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's these kinds of data or stats or research that's coming out that's making people terrified. I mean, I had a whole lot of calls today saying, Akram, you're going around saying Huawei's bringing this amazing technology, bringing AI to mobility and making it accessible to everybody. Mm. But is it actually going to kill us and take our jobs, et cetera, et cetera? And you guys mentioned a lot about education. You spoke about very correctly that we don't know where AI is going to go. Mm. We know it's bound to happen, but can we put a timeline to it and what impact it would have? We don't really know. The problem I have is that it's not just us that don't know. Government doesn't know. The general public don't know. It's amazing how many friends and family that I speak to right now looks at AI and say, no, man, it's way in the future. It doesn't even exist as yet. And on the other end, you have loads of people that say, well, it's right here and it's going to kill us based on all the data and all the information that's out on the internet. So you've got this happening. And the point is, before we can even get into education and see how we change our education system, how can we change the understanding of what this is? And even industry don't really know. I mean, us as Huawei, there's a few key players in the market that tend to control AI at the moment of the development, and it's just a race to see who gets there first, almost. Even within Huawei itself, we know the power or the potential it has, but can we put a timeline on what it means? And I think the essence of bringing it into a smartphone right now is we looked at it first of making it available to everybody, but also as the first step into that education. Because if you are able to bring it, put it into a smartphone and make it accessible to everybody, the capability at the moment in a smartphone probably is just limited to the camera functionality or the system processing or your battery enhancement. But it's a way of getting people involved and getting them to understand and getting them to talk about it. And if it can change their user experience and the way they interact with their devices, it perhaps can make them understand the potential of it changing the way they interact with the world.
Yeah.
And I think that is where we're sitting, and that's the critical point. And it brings it back again to mobility. I mean, if you're looking at the future of work, we don't know where it's going to go. But one thing's for certain, and I can speak about us here at Huawei within this organization, is just a few years ago, it was mainly people sitting behind desks, crunching numbers, putting things together. How do we get to number three, or how do we get to number two? Whereas now we have more people working remotely. We've mobilized most of our team, and the guys are there actively selling, where you need the human interaction. Yeah. And we stopped using so much of our in-house systems and technologies, but actually went completely mobile. And we looked at that as an example. If an international corporation like us find the benefit in doing this, can we perhaps take similar types of technologies, use our experience, use our R&D and everything else that we have, say, let's roll it out to the general public and as well to business around the world and see what perhaps could happen. You made mention about artificial intelligence regarding the facial recognition, object recognition, natural language translation. Yeah. These are some of the key aspects with regards to our latest device, the Mate 10 Pro. But it's not just about enhancing the types of pictures you could take. I mean, pointing your phone and taking an amazing picture because the AI understands and it automatically says is great.
It's not going to make Mike look better.
Trust me, it will. Make you lose 5 kilograms. Very simple.
But perhaps this technology, you know, working with developers, and I mean, we chatted outside about TensorFlow and all of these things, could evolve into something completely different. Functionality and technical ability that we don't even know about, like we're discussing now. You could perhaps point your camera at food in a restaurant and tells you how many calories are in there, which will be really beneficial for you, for yourself.
Yeah, thanks, man.
But, you know, these are the kind of things we're looking at and seeing how can we use this practical, everyday usage and bring that. But going back to the topic about would hardware eat software, I think it's important because all companies, the likes of Intel, the Qualcomms, are just chasing transistor count at the moment, you know, and saying, well, the more transistors you have, the better. But it's also very important how you integrate software into that. And if they talk to each other really well, then you're going to see that enhancement. We've had many chipsets released by many of the chip manufacturers over the past few years. But in terms of clock speed, in terms of true performance enhancements, each year with the new generation, you've seen very minimal change.
Mm.
But once you get that sweet spot of integrating this together, and that is why with our AI chipset, with the NPU, we are encouraging collaboration. We are saying we've made it open platform based on Tensor, based on Cafe. We've encouraging developers to try and see this processing power, which we have and we don't know the full potential of. Can you smart guys out there take software that can talk to this and just work together really well? And I think that's where we're sitting at.
So you're going to tap into the gig economy, right?
Correct, yes.
So, I mean, like, developers have been leading that gig economy front where just sharing and open sourcing code and knowledge and ideas has been phenomenal. But I guess now we're entering this world where the scale of that gig economy goes beyond developers, goes into the business space. Could it go into the world of education? Just actually a thought on that, Brian. What do you reckon?
It has moved into the world of educators to a large extent. Mm. So, I mean, what I see at the university is that the people who actually do the educating, a lot of them are in the gig economy.
Yeah.
I think to move into the gig economy on the part, I think it's very plausible that people will start putting together a package of education and inputs for themselves from a whole range of different sources in different modes. at different times. So in a sense, that's the gig economy as a consumer rather than as a provider. I think it can work both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess there's one challenge I have with the gig economy. There's a lot of legislation that's still very out of date around all the benefits on the workers, and we're making people work even harder, right? So I wonder if I guess the more code, the more libraries that are out there, we shouldn't be working as hard. Or are we going to create different problems that we require the different skill sets again to go out there and solve those different problems? I don't think we're ever going to run out of those problems. Or are we?
Hey. Am I allowed to say I don't know?
I'm just kind of like, oh crap, are we never going to not have any problems?
See,
I thought that was just South Africa.
Brett just wanted to set you two up there. Just to see your reaction.
As Brian mentioned before, I mean, yes, you would still have those problems, but the work or the job becomes more meaningful. You know, so you're not doing the mundane stuff. I think the technology and AI will just amplify what you currently do. The more human side of things, the empathy side of things will be what we use. I mean, for example, you would require more project managers that's handling something specific for a space of time rather than having somebody to come in here and formulate the entire direction of the business. You might have one person doing that, and you don't need everybody to just sit the administrative tasks, the mundane tasks. But you would need somebody to specifically come in and handle a product launch or a specific campaign. And stuff that needs the actual human element. And I think that is where we would see the shift coming from.
So maybe, I guess, two thoughts on that. So what we can say is that AI will solve any problem for which there is a training set. So anything where there has been a previous example of that problem or that question, eventually AI will be able to solve it better, faster, more reliably than a human being will be able to. So the question is, will there be more problems? There will always be an arrangement of circumstances where there's no training set for that, and that's when a human being will probably be at least as good as a computer in solving that, right? So I think that sort of problem, they won't go away, but the routine problems for which there's a training set, which is probably about 95% of what we deal with now, that goes away, right? So I think, will there be more problems? I think the other thing is you'll lead towards a concentration of skills. You spoke about concentration of the economy. But that means there'll be fewer and fewer of these really, really tougher and tougher and tougher challenges where there's no training information available, which will need incredibly more and more incredibly skilled people and insightful people to solve them, which logically leads on, this is on the problem solving side, logically leads to a concentration of skills, therefore concentration of wealth and all those bad things on the skills front. You can argue the same will apply in the creative and the socially interactive things.
Absolutely.
It will be the stuff that really needs to be, can't be done by a computer, so you'll get concentration. Final point, in sales and so on. I think the good thing is at the moment we're all humans, right? And we are the people who make buying decisions. We haven't yet relinquished the buy decision to our computers. So you still make decisions on an emotional basis. All the research.
I've relinquished my clothing decisions to my wife.
but to another human being who's probably even more emotional. So that says to me, I mean, the way we engage with our customers, it's a big mistake that we think we're going digital, therefore treat your customers like machines.
Wrong.
Customers remain human beings. We think, we feel, we love, we hate, we laugh, we cry.
And we think with our emotions.
The way you engage with your customers is you do that.
And same thing for your staff, right?
Absolutely.
Because we're all human. Yeah, guys, absolutely. I think we've hit the...
We're getting to the end.
Right at the end here.
But I just want to check. Are there any more questions? Does anyone want to ask anything?
I'm Andrew? Really worried when Andrew puts his hand up to it. Wander across. So guys, we are nearing the end, so we're going to take one more question. Andrew.
I'll try and make it quick. Awesome discussion. Thank you. Andrew McHenry. Awesome discussion, talks, but again, I mean, I travel Africa a lot, and this talk about technology and AI, we need to connect people. It needs to be affordable. That, to me, all this wonderful stuff that you're talking about, unless we solve that problem, you know, hashtag data must fall, been going for a while. Yeah. Seriously, not to harp on it, but, you know, this is actually all irrelevant until we solve that problem, okay? And, yeah, that's my point. I mean, the next Einstein is under a tree in Africa. How do we get him connected or her connected? Mm. That's what I'm saying. Gamification, that's what I do for a living. I support all that stuff. We build games, teach people how to, you know, work, save and all that. I'm all for all that, but we got to connect more people. Okay, that's what I want to say. Thank you very much.
I agree 100%. We've got to get more people connected. We've got to get everybody connected, and it has to be affordable. What I don't necessarily agree with is that data is completely out of kilter in South Africa on average. If you actually look at the blended tariff per megabyte in South Africa, it's not shocking. It's not the best in the world. It's not the worst. Where I think the mobile operators have missed a trick is that they've made the high-profile parts of their price of their portfolio, namely entry-level data packages and out-of-bundle usage.
Okay.
It is just stupidly priced, in my opinion, and they need to get more street smart in how they price it. But if you look at the average cost of producing a megabyte of data is between 1 and 2 cents. There's packages that are actually below that.
Okay.
I just want to add from a device perspective to that. You know, it's connectivity. Yes, the operators are doing all of this, but also from an OEM perspective, as innovation expands and becomes more rapid, the cost goes down, and we are seeing that within ourselves as well. So in terms of making hardware with these kind of capabilities more affordable, that's also something we are looking at. So you would find in the future, probably in the next year perhaps, that you will get flagship general chipsets and screen technology, etc., filtering down to more mid-tier and entry-level products. So from a Huawei perspective, also, that's somewhere we're trying to contribute in terms of bringing price down in connecting people.
Lovely. Fantastic. Any other questions? Jared. At the back there.
So, yeah, thanks, guys. Great talk. So back to the future of work discussion. As things are starting to change, as you've highlighted, the gig economy, different skill sets that are going to be valued. My experience in working, you know, people are being evaluated under quite a narrow band of KPIs, indicators, and you spoke about creativity and dexterity and, you know, social competence as kind of important skill sets. Do you see a change in how people are going to be valued within the work environment, as in like how people are gauged in terms of their performance, or how do you see that evolution happening in terms of how people are, how do you discern between those that are excelling and those aren't excelling, and what types of KPIs do you see in terms of that evolution as things get more and more automated?
I must admit, I'm part of the world of hashtag KPIs must fall. And I know it's in total contradiction to running large organizations, because you're trying to put in the processes to get the stability and de-risk and a lot of things. And when I look at ways of working, it really goes down that route of trust and trying to establish smaller teams that are cross-functional, that are really controlling their own domains and basing their KPIs around a different set of data. So, and really that data, what we're starting to see is more around what the consumer's interaction or experience or feedback loops, and you respond to that. Yeah. As well as, of course, your commercial metrics, but rather than having a manager define what your KPI is to fit into a process. But that's my crazy-ass, weird, hippie opinion, right?
But I actually like the idea, because, I mean, the worst KPI that we actually have is called matric, and that's where it actually starts. I mean, we talk about education. Everything is designed to deliver against matric, which then ripples up into the education system as it goes forward.
But, I mean, the matric's an interesting... So my sense is that KPIs are a measure of what we value. So if we value... So as an employer, if we value a person that's got a matric more highly than a person without a matric, if we value a person with a university degree more highly than we value a person without a university degree, then that becomes the KPI. Now, in the traditional business sense, what we value in business is driven by economic orthodoxy, which has been around for 200 years and is probably out of date. Which says we are driven, what is the economic orthodoxy, that the value of the business depends on the revenue it generates, the profits it generates, its free cash flow, return on capital invested, all those usual measures. So if that's how the world views a company, it's not surprising to expect the company to translate that value system onto its employees. Yeah. And until the broader value system, which says a company's value is not only about the profit that it generates, I mean, it clearly is about the profit, but maybe it goes beyond that. It does go towards a more holistic version of what is value. Once we get that right, then we can think about translating that into KPIs.
Fantastic. I think that was a great session. I'm going to ask for final thoughts from you guys.
I think the conversation is only beginning.
Yeah, I have to agree.
We know far less. We know less than. There's more we don't know than we do.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, I think we need to be careful over these big discussions. Which someone said, you know, we have a lot of discussions about that AI and technology is that we are inventing ourselves out of existence. I think the short term real issues is we are inventing ourselves out of a society that is fractured and is the center's not holding. And I mean, we've got short-term issues. We need to be aware of the long-term. But let's think about, are we inventing ourselves out of employment? Are we inventing ourselves out of a stable, coherent society?
Yeah.
Vikram? This is most certainly, we're at our infancy in this space. So I think forums like this, platforms like this help us to engage and start the conversation. And I commend you guys, and I think we need to do this more frequently, perhaps, and get involved with more role players and see how can we make, especially from industry, I mean, we would like to believe we're the pioneers in this space. How can we contribute to that difference and to that change? So, yeah, I think from our side, that's my closing. Oh, actually, the final thing I want to say, Brett, it's Huawei.
Huawei. Huawei. I've been criticizing Mike on not saying Huawei properly.
You're a hard practice. I can't even say Brett's name properly.
St. Clair.
But guys, I'd just like to say thank you. It's been absolutely incredible. You've jinxed me.
No, but seriously, guys, thank you. So, Huawei, you guys have been fabulous sponsors. What you are doing with the devices and changing the way of work and the thinking around how you advance the workspace and challenge the PC era and start moving away from this world of always being connected to being offline with your artificial intelligence stacks. We can truly see how the impact's going to happen in this way of working. So thank you for sharing your innovation center. It's absolutely fabulous. So anyone who isn't here, guys, we are going to do this as a standard. It's how we're going to broadcast. We're going to find venues that are stunning, and we are going to get the community and you guys, an audience. Guys, you guys have been fabulous. Just give yourselves a round of applause for our guests. So I've been blown away, guys. The Huawei team have been amazing. The innovation center is just incredible. So until next week, ladies and gentlemen, we're super amped. Mike?
Yeah, I'm. You know what? This has been really good fun, Brett. And
I love having a live audience. The guys are amazing.
It's different, eh? They actually ask questions. It changes the whole dynamic. It's pretty cool.
It's really difficult for Mike to handle answering questions.
It's terribly difficult because I'm actually quite an introvert at heart. So.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please follow us, like us, the rest of that. And until next time.
Cheerio.
Cheerio. CliffCentral.com.